This is one of the things that the 43 Group is known by and should be known in the future, that you do not wait to be attacked. You take the fight of the enemy and attack those before they attack you. We do find ourselves in a very tricky situation, sometimes outnumbered. Anything you do to deter people from nasty things they want to do was a good thing.
Hello, welcome to the first episode of Radio 43 of 2024. This is the Anti-Fascism Podcast from Hope Not Hate. And if this is your first time here, then this is the show where we go through what's been going on in the far right and also looking ahead at some future problems. I want to start this show with something of an apology because we've been absolutely slammed. Joe's going to tell you just about, you know, just how slammed we've been this year already. But we've been really slammed with State of Hate and we just haven't had a chance to sit down and talk. Yet we haven't been able to align our calendars at all. So I'm really glad that we're doing this now. I've got Joe here with me. My name's Nick. Joe, how you doing, mate?
Good, mate. Yeah.
No, because you were just saying before we recorded, you were just like absolutely slammed as well.
Yeah, exhausted. But no, good. It's just been a really busy start to the year, isn't it? But it feels like it's been a very long time since we've done one of these. So it's nice to be back.
Definitely, definitely. Start as we mean to go on. And we're going to be publishing State of Hate pretty soon, right? When does it come out?
Very soon. It depends when this podcast gets published, but it'll be in the next. You know, I'd imagine it'll be very, very soon indeed. It's there now, so it's always this enormous bit. For those who don't know, State of Hate's our big yearly report that kind of lists and profiles all of the made far right figures and groups, and there's lots of exposés and investigations and stories, and there's loads of new polling this year, so it's going to be great. But we'll do a special one on that, or maybe even a series, but yeah, that should be out very soon.
Yeah, I think I've mapped out three potential shows off the back of it, so I think there's some good stuff in there as always, but there's some really, really spicy stuff in there this year, so looking forward to talking with you about that. Okay, on the show this week we are going to be talking about a new Homeland expose. That's the PA Splinter Group, which we published earlier on this week. We're going to be looking a sort of a general roundup of things that have happened this year, because as I mentioned, it's taken us a bit of time to get around to doing this. But we're going to start with a big piece which we did last week, which is this story on Paul Marshall. One of our colleagues, Gregory, who's in the research team, he did an investigation on a guy called Paul Marshall, who he owns Unheard. He part owns GB News. I think he's got 49% stake there. You might be able to correct me on that, Joe.
41, I think.
41. Okay.
41.2, but yeah.
Okay, nice. Well, when we want to be absolutely accurate on this podcast, so that's good to know. And he's been trying to buy the Telegraph and the Spectator. So two, you know, important outlets on the kind of British right and you know, sort of hard right, I suppose, some of it. And if the deal goes through, Paul Marshall, he's going to become one of the most powerful media owners in this country. And last week we published an expose. We published some details on what we'd found, or what our colleague Gregory had found, on Paul Marshall's private anonymized Twitter account. And it really did not look good at all. I mean, this story actually, it went quite bananas, didn't it, Joe? It really took off. But before we get into that, why don't we talk about the content of this stuff? So you went on the News Agents podcast, to go and talk about it. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the details were that we found?
Yeah, sure. So as you kind of mentioned, I mean, Paul Marshall's already a pretty influential figure, and I guess he became more interesting to us through the GB News stuff and the funding of GB News. And we've obviously been talking about our concerns about the impact that GB News has been having on the right to the Conservative Party and that radical right ecosystem around it. But he's, you know, he's been a big Tory donor. He used to be a Lib Dem. He was also kind of donated towards the Leave campaign. So he's been a quite influential figure in this space for a while. Now, broadly speaking, as you mentioned, my colleague Gregory had been kind of looking at his social media. He used to have a social media in his own name, Paul Marshall, and then eventually he shifted it. He changed it from a kind of open and public account to a private account, which means that you can only see it if you're already following him. But he also stripped the account of any kind of identifying stuff like his name. Previously it said he was the founder of Unheard, for example. That was all taken away. And he changed the name of the account to, and I always can get this pronunciation wrong, Areopagus. which is actually the name of a company that he set up in 2001 called Areopagus Ventures. Mm. So it's gone from public to private. One of the things we noticed was just under this private account, he was liking and retweeting really extreme stuff. And I don't mean kind of stuff that you might slightly disagree with. I mean, it's even way more extreme than the sort of content that you'd expect on GB News. Some of it was that he was retweeting and liking far right figures. So, you know, he liked and retweeted or endorsed tweets by Britain First Deputy Leader Ashley Simon, anti-Muslim campaigners like Amy Meek, El Mek, and Radio Genoa, and all these sorts of things. So he was obviously like consuming content from very extreme places. But some of the content, I think it is worth just mentioning some of it, because some of it, as I say, the people who've criticized the article, people like Douglas Murray and those that will come on to have said, oh, this is just, you know, people that don't like open borders. It's actually way more extreme than that. And some of those examples are, you know, liking or retweeting stuff about a civil war starting in Europe. One of them was said the native European population is losing patience with fake refugee invaders. One of them said we don't stand a chance unless we start the process of kind of mass expulsions of migrants. So we've got really extreme anti-Muslim content, often by well-known far-right figures. The other stuff was kind of Geert Wilders, etc. But also there was conspiratorial content. So there was anti-Ukraine stuff. There was climate change denial. Together, and this was our case, is that while the tweets, and it's important to say, weren't written by Paul Marshall, they were just liked and retweeted by him. Together, there was a pattern of social media activity by Paul Marshall, which is really, really concerning. This wasn't just like a slip of the thumb. It wasn't just that he liked or retweeted one thing that we disagreed with. I think from the beginning of January this year, there was roughly 150, 155 odd tweets on the account, and somewhere around 40 or just over 40 crossed lines that were, you know, quite explicit lines for us. They were either far right, they were anti-Muslim, they were anti-LGBT. There was some content in there kind of supporting Viktor Orban as a true leader for his anti-LGBT politics. He also reposted a tweet that seemed to compare worshipping Satan with homosexuality. So there was all these different types of prejudices, and it wasn't just one or two pieces, as Paul Marshall himself kind of defended. It was a pattern of behavior.
Yeah, it's really, really grim stuff. What was Paul Marshall's response then? Because, I mean, this stuff is, you know, like you said, absolutely nailed on, really, that it's him, and that, you know, we knew it was him. The content's really extreme. What was his response? Did he deny it?
No. I mean, we obviously went to him for comment got a legal letter or a letter back from his lawyers. And actually, I'll read it in full, his statement, just because he's a multimillionaire and I'm not. This was the quote we were sent over. Paul Marshall's account is private, but is nonetheless followed by 5,000 people, including many journalists. He posts on a wide variety of subjects, and those cited represent a small and unrepresentative sample of over 5,000 posts. This sample does not represent his views. As most X/Twitter users know, it can be a fountain of ideas, but some of it is of uncertain quality, and all his posts have now been deleted to avoid any further misunderstanding. So, I mean, within, I would say, an hour or so of us sending over the allegations to him for comment, we started to notice that tweets were being deleted very quickly. And then by the end, kind of all the tweets had been deleted. But I think we cannot say, obviously, we can't prove what he believes or what he agrees with or what he is. But what I think we can say is that there was a pattern of behavior that is pretty clear here. And I think, you know, claiming that it's just a very small and unrepresentative sample, I don't think is tenable, really. When you, as I say, if you look from the beginning of the year, 40 of about 150 odd were pretty clearly crossed our lines. And I guess the broad element here is he has questions to answer, and I don't think he's answered them yet, right? If he really doesn't believe this stuff, and it's just the marketplace of ideas, why did he like and retweet so much content by explicitly far-right figures, or discriminatory and prejudiced content, or conspiratorial content? Why was he liking so much of that content, and why wasn't there loads of other content on there from left-wing groups, or, yeah, you know, if he was just liking it all? So I don't think the defense is very, very strong, and it does accept that the account was his. And then the final big question here has to be, is this the sort of person that is suitable to be buying an enormous piece of our media real estate in terms of the Telegraph and Spectator, two very influential publications, especially within the Conservative Party and on the right of British politics, is someone that has engaged in this kind of pattern of behaviour on social media a suitable figure? And that's, I guess, maybe you can talk a little bit about it, but why we've got our supporters and ourselves have written to both Ofcom and the DCMS to kind of ask those questions about whether or not he is a suitable figure.
Yeah, it's really alarming. I completely agree. There's been a bit of a backlash, though, hasn't there, to the story? I mean, first of all, our website was hit by some kind of bot attack maybe an hour, 2 hours after we went public with this story. Do we know what happened with that in the end?
No. We've kind of got our security company looking into it, but it looks like there was some form of bot attack and the website went down for a period and we had to massively kind of increase security on it. And then in the days that followed... Sorry.
No. I was going to say, and then we've obviously had, there's been a backlash from certain figures, particularly around the Spectator, you know, people obviously with a, you know, potential future working relationship with Paul Marshall who are trying to shore up their own perspectives or positions, I guess. I mean, we've had Douglas Murray, who's published a piece today, but it doesn't come out in print until the end of the week, I think. But do you want to talk a little bit about that? I mean, he's obviously had a little bit of a pot shot at us. It was very weak. Yeah. I mean, I read the thing. I thought it was going to be quite interesting, but it was a very, very bad piece, I thought.
Yeah, no, it was really, really, it was comically weak, I would say. And it's, so the usual characters kind of came out and attacked us, obviously. GB News did a piece on it where they called us, you know, far left extremists and stuff. And then actually that video, we've retweeted it because it's also quite comical in how much they're floundering as they're being challenged about the question. Douglas Murray tweeted about us being a hate group. Fraser Nelson, who's the editor of The Spectator, accused us of running a smear campaign. But none of them, of course, got into any detail about the fact that they are leaping to the defense of someone who's attempting to buy the magazine they work for, or in case of GB News, already owns. The new piece by Douglas Murray today is, as I say, it's lazy and comical, and I won't get into great detail about it. But one of the big defences that people have offered so far for Paul Marshall is that this is somehow a smear campaign, and that basically it's based on he liked and retweeted a load of stuff that most people agree with. None of them have engaged with the fact that most people do not agree with tweets like the one I mentioned where they about the forced removal of migrants from Britain. That is clearly an extremist position. And it's nice and that's a nice try to kind of say, oh, you know, it was broadly, you know, stuff about immigration that everyone agrees with. The investigation, and do have a look at it on the website, goes into lots of details with lots of examples of content, which is, it's unquestionably classified as extremist material. So no one's really kind of got to grips with it properly, but the usual names have kind of jumped up and down about it. And I would even encourage people to go read the Douglas Murray one because it's so pathetic.
It's really bad. I mean, it ends on a line saying that we should be called hate, not hope, which, I mean, as long-time listeners to the podcast will know, if, you know, the number of times we're called that, if we were given a pound for that, we would never have to send out another election, another fundraiser ever again. So really cringe from him, I think.
Well, the other thing he said was, the media slavishly call us anti-fascists. And that's just not true. I mean, we're always asking the media to call us anti-fascists, and usually they don't do it. They'll say anti-extremist or anti, you know, something else, but they won't say, they never, so, I mean, it was just, he'd obviously read two articles and then kind of hobbled together an opinion, but there we go.
Yeah, anyway, we spent enough time on him. I mean, people can read that when it comes out, but yeah, it's not good. Let's move on. Next story is going to be on Homeland, which is one of the PA splinter groups. This was a group that popped up April last year. Kenny Smith, who was an officer in PA, he led a pretty large defection of lots of different PA officers, and they formed their own group, the Homeland Party. They've been working on a community level for quite a while now, since that time. And then on 31st of January this year, after quite a few failed attempts, they've actually been successful in registering as a political party. So the Homeland Party is now officially a political party. Quite embarrassing for PA because they've been trying to do that for a long time and they have not been successful. But obviously a concern for anti-fascists. They're now looking at the local elections for success, and they're trying to, as I say, get a foothold in communities and kind of build from there. They've already got several community and parish councillors, which are the sort of the lowest level in British politics. And on Tuesday, one of our colleagues published an expose, the first of several pieces on Homeland and its regional branches. And this one was on the West Midlands, where there are a couple of those community and parish councillors, as I mentioned. And I think in the kind of the background to these exposés, these pieces, is to sort of shine a light on the true extremity of this new political party. They've been trying to, Homeland's been trying to shake off the ties to PA, because PA is, you know, so toxic. But obviously most of its activists come from that same world and very much involved with the same reprehensible ideology, you know, walked out of PA. So I think it's important that we shine a light on Homeland and the true extremity of the group. Joe, you've been looking at this as well. In the West Midlands Homeland branch, there are some, how can we put this, interesting characters?
Yeah. So this is some really, really great research by my colleague, David Lawrence. And as I say, the West Midlands branch of Homeland is their kind of stronghold. And it's where they were one of the branches that was PA, but split away, as you say, and it's kind of one of the stronger ones within Homeland. I won't go through all the details. I will just name a few of the people. Connor Marlowe is kind of talked at in some length, and I would encourage people to look at the blog on the website, because some of the pictures, they are very, very extreme, but also some of them are quite funny. Not the extreme ones, but the other ones are quite funny. Who's the kind of regional organizer for the West Mids is Connor Marlowe. And you know, there's pictures in there of the Hitler, you know, his stuff around Hitler and his wild anti-Semitism and kind of pictures of Auschwitz, just really disgusting stuff. And another guy that's kind of talked about in some length is a guy called Chris Gilmartin. And there's some really worrying stuff in there in terms of veneration of terrorists, not just people like, you know, the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, but, you know, really vile, very extreme racial slurs, praise for the Christchurch shooter, Brenton Tarrant. Really, as you say, really showing that this is a party that their social media content shows them out doing litter picks and handing out leaflets, but the reality behind it is that this is kind of almost as extreme as you can get. Another one from the kind of Birmingham area is Martin Kuziel, and then there is also a guy called Tom King, who's from Birmingham. And Tom King, for the very long-term listeners or people that have been reading Hope Not Hate content for a very long time, was an activist in Generation Identity UK. Many, many years ago, kind of the 2008 or 2019, 2020, that sort of period. And again, you know, tweet messages like Happy Birthday, Uncle A, on the 20th of April. So again, talking about Hitler. And then just to show that they're not just the younger crowd, there is Liam Hart, AKA Liam Connor, who's based in Stoke-on-Trent. And, you know, here's pictures of him and his band at the Ian Stuart Donaldson Memorial gig in September 23. And broadly speaking, I think there's a couple of things to say about all this. And if you're interested in the specifics, go and have a look at the blog, and all the detail from my colleague David is in there, and it's really worth a read. And it does, as you say, show just how extreme it is. One is, as we've mentioned, the huge difference between the image that they're presenting and the image that they're going to present now that they're a registered political party when it comes to local campaigns, when it comes to knocking on doors and delivering leaflets, compared to the reality of what their actual beliefs are, which are explicitly Nazi, explicitly fascist, and in some cases, overtly pro-terrorism. The other thing here is what this means, as you mentioned, for Patriotic Alternative. You know, Homeland really got off to a slow start when they split away in April and were really struggling to get a foothold and grounding. But they have started to wrestle that momentum of Patriotic Alternative in the last 4 or 5 months or so, 6 months. The registration as a political party, as you say, is a huge embarrassment for Patriotic Alternative, which have failed to get that done. And also in terms of size of the two parties or the two groups now, they're starting to look much more comparable. Whether or not Homeland will be able to keep this momentum going and manage to kind of completely usurp Patriotic Alternative, it will be one to watch. In one sense, it's good news. I mean, it's always a danger when the far right has a single major fascist organization that has a gravitational pull that pulls activists around it. Having two vying for positions, disliking each other, attacking each other, and splitting it so there's no kind of, neither of them are full national forces is a positive. But they are definitely the ones that are at the moment doing the running and probably kind of wrestling some of the momentum away from PA.
Yeah, I think as well, just on the point about splitting, is that Alec Yerbury, who was formerly in PA, set up his own group last year called the National Support Detachment with Scott Pitts. He has announced yesterday that his application to form a political party has been successful. And I've seen, you know, he's been posting that around and whatnot. But I think
poorly designed leaflets coming to a house near you.
Right, exactly. But also, there seems to be a bit of a backlash to that as well. People already saying, you know, why have we got another political party? Blah, 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 blah. So I think the splitting thing that you just mentioned there is absolutely true. But I think that's another one to watch, see what he's up to. I just want to point one thing out quickly, which was you spoke about this guy, Connor Marlow, at the beginning, who, you know, there's pictures of him sea-kyling and posting pictures of Adolf Hitler and picture of Auschwitz with a smiley face on it. He is a parish councillor.
Yeah.
At the moment. I just want to stress that point. He is now officially a parish councillor. And I just wanted to make that point absolutely clear. That is pretty shocking.
That's a tactic, actually. That's a tactic that, like, fascist groups have used for decades, which is you have absolutely no chance of winning a council election at a proper level. But getting on to kind of parish council levels, community councils, those sorts of lower levels is obviously much, much easier. And it's a tactic that these sorts of parties have long used as a way to build credibility. You know, people like ourselves are saying that they're extremists and they're fascists, and we have all the evidence, but we're saying that sort of thing. And they use the title of councillor and parish councillor as a way, because it gives them a bit of a cachet in the local community, and it makes them appear less extreme than they actually are. And fascist groups have always done that.
Yeah.
It's not right, and I agree with you. And I think you know, one of the great things about this series by David is this: we're going to do one branch at a time, digging into each branch and highlighting the key figures and what they've been up to. But it also allows us to engage with the local media one space at a time. It also allows us to, when there are councillors, to go to those councils and explain how dangerous it is that these figures are currently being represented there.
Steve Laws is sniffing. Steve Laws, the migrant hunter from down in Kent, he's been sniffing around Homeland as well. Do we think he might possibly stand for them? I don't know.
I mean, Steve Laws has been on a... Too early to say. He's been on a very... I mean, Steve Laws has got way more extreme than when we started talking about him on this podcast a few, you know, back in 2019 or so. He's certainly been making overtures. He's certainly been kind of welcoming Homeland becoming a registered political party.
Hmm.
It's more telling about his journey, really, that he is now in a space where his natural place probably would be something like Homeland, which wouldn't have been the case when, you know, he stood for UKIP previously, he was in For Britain previously, the anti-Muslim party, and some, you know, when he first burst onto the scene, Homeland would have been deemed way too extreme for him. So it kind of shows the journey that he's been on.
Possibly watch this space on that, potentially.
Yeah.
Finally, has there been any response from Homeland? I haven't seen anything from them at all, but I don't know whether you have. Have they commented on on the piece?
It's only just been published, so it's early days yet. But no, I mean, as of yet, there's been no kind of direct response from them. But there's been some nice pickup on social media, and we've had lots of messages in about it from interesting people. But we haven't seen much from Homeland themselves yet.
Cool. Okay, as Joe says, go to our website, check it out if you want to read the whole thing. It's a really good piece. Same with the Paul Marshall investigation. All right, let's do a quick fire roundup because we're running out of time and we need to crack on. So the first thing is, let's talk about Britain First very, very quickly. Today, as we record, is the Rochdale by-election. Seems like an appropriate place to start because, as anyone who's been watching our social media will know, the Britain First got themselves into a little bit of a tangle with the Rochdale by-election. They suggested, I think it was after the nominations had closed, that they were on the ballot paper, sent out a fundraising call to fundraise for their election campaign, and then Hope Not Hate showed that they weren't on the ballot paper and that maybe all was not as it seemed, and they quickly backtracked and deleted absolutely everything of that. So that was quite embarrassing. They also stood at the Wellingborough by-election, didn't they, Joe? Alex Marola, he got 1.6% of the vote, became eighth out of 11 potential candidates. So it's not been a great start to the year for Britain First, I have to say. Tommy Robinson recently turned up. Was it a conference? What was this thing?
Yeah.
It was a conference.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll come on to the conference, but yeah, I mean,
sorry,
just to laugh at the electoral result again. I mean, Britain First has spent a lot of time presenting themselves as the kind of the reasonable, the organised, the professional nationalist party, and this is just another in the, I mean, even more disastrous than the ones we've talked about previously. I mean, 477 votes, 1.6% of the vote. They put in a lot of work into that council seat as well. They did direct mails. They had lots of days of action. They spent a lot of time down there. And it was a pretty disastrous result. And actually, it's prompted quite a bit of discussion within the wider far right about saying, well, actually, this electoral, you know, we talk about these new parties being registered, but actually, what's the point in this electoral route when Britain First, which is the most professional out of all of them at the moment in terms of campaigning, is getting such embarrassing results on such a regular basis. And then the Rochdale thing, the only two options there are, it was either a complete grift, so they put out a fundraiser, they wanted to make money, but they weren't going to stand, or it was complete incompetence, and they didn't get their papers in time, or they messed up their papers or something. Those are the only two options. So again, that's also quite amusing.
Far right have a long and storied history of messing up bureaucracy, don't they, when it comes to comes to election stuff. But sorry, exactly. Just before we come to the conference, I want to say one thing, which is this pain for Britain First at the ballot box is not going to be over because Nick Scanlon is standing in the London mayoral elections, which I think we would agree is going to go catastrophically badly for Britain First. And presumably they're going to be putting candidates up for local elections. I don't know if they have already announced that, but I'm assuming they'll put somebody up in Salford, Ashley Simon again, probably. So the pain will go on when it comes to the losses at the ballot box.
We definitely need to watch the local elections as things start to get announced there. As you say, the London mayoral elections, I mean, obviously it goes without saying they've got no chance. I think the only thing to say about that is they're going to be really, really nasty about Sadiq Khan. They're going to be really anti-Muslim. They're going to be really Islamophobic. They're already talking about targeting, and they've already started, you know, the videos have popped up of previous times they've talked about Sadiq. I think they've got no chance of doing anything other than another embarrassing result. But they are going to seek to whip up anti-Muslim prejudice, and they're going to really, really target Sadiq Khan. So that's going to be nasty, whatever happens.
Definitely. Tell me about this conference then.
Yeah. So the conference, smaller than some of the ones they've had previously in terms of their kind of regional or yearly conferences and stuff. This was a hotel and spa over in Leicester. Only two things of interest came out of it. One was Tommy Robinson was there, as you mentioned. He actually put out a video before the Wellingborough by-election saying for his supporters to support Britain First. He's obviously been close with Golding for many, many years now, so that came as no great surprise. But he went along and gave a talk. The only other interesting thing is they slightly changed Britain First, their kind of governance, or the way it operates, is that Paul Golding is obviously the leader. His partner, Ashley Simon, who's got her own string of disastrous electoral results, has been made equal or co-leader. So they've changed it now so that they have two leaders at the top. And Ashley's going to be doing the political side and Paul will be doing the kind of organisational structural stuff at side. I don't think in reality will have any impact whatsoever. I think it's more that they feel that Ashley is a softer face to put forward to the public than Paul Golding is, and she obviously has a bit less baggage than him as well. Or at least fewer pictures drunk at the cenotaph than he does. So that came out of the conference as well. But other than that, it feels like a party that is stagnating, which is good news. You know, they have put in a huge amount of work in recent years. They've really tried to professionalise. They're doing a lot. I mean, they're extremely active. They have the best probably structures of any fascist organisation in the UK. But the number, you know, the membership is a hugely high turnover, continues to be really quickly turning over. They're not growing at any sort of scale, and they're not getting footholds in the way that they thought they would after the amount of work they're doing. So it must be a really dispiriting place to be right now, which is good news.
It is good news. I can't believe that Tommy would be standing for them at a local election level. He's too much. I mean, you know, he's too much of an egomaniac. He'd want a big shot, right? MP seat or, you know.
I think it's unlikely. I mean, if you look at the times that he has stood when he stood in the kind of European elections up in the Northwest and those sorts of places, I don't see that he is going to... firstly, Paul Golding is, you know, in his head, runs Britain First like it's some sort of military outfit, not just the embarrassing uniforms and stuff, but, you know, chief of staff and these sorts of terms. So I don't see Tommy Robinson being comfortable working under him as a candidate or anything like that. I think the egos are too big. And also, I just don't see him wanting to run a local campaign knocking on doors for ages. Now, it's not impossible. Mm. It's not an impossibility, and we shouldn't say it could never happen, but I think at the moment it still looks unlikely.
Seems unlikely. Okay, quickly, two other things. First is Anne-Marie Waters, who people who listen to the podcast and readers of Hope Not Hate will know, founder of the For Britain Party, very anti-Muslim party, failed UKIP leadership bid in the past, or was she previously the UKIP leader? I can't remember. She was definitely in and around UKIP, obviously, before then. She has now officially launched her UKIP leadership bid. She made a speech over the weekend in Hartlepool in some sort of town hall, where she, you know, she's now nailed her colours to the mast and said she's going to be running on the ticket for the UKIP leadership. She has been very extreme, I think, this year. She made an opportunistic visit to Scampton, the RAF Scampton, the collapsed, disastrous RAF Scampton camp earlier this year, to try and curry favour. And I saw a bit of a clip that she made with a guy called Alan Merritt, who's a mate of Tommy Robinson's or something. And she was very extreme. But I don't know if you've got any comment on that, Joe. I mean,
no, I mean, look, with Anne-Marie Waters, even I struggle to care about this. And I mean, a UKIP is such a joke these days. But I mean, Anne-Marie Waters, she still is, as far as I know, she's still the justice spokesperson for UKIP, which seems like a bit of an oxymoron. But she's running for it. I mean, they have very, very few activists left. They still have a name recognition, and actually their accounts are interesting in that they still have more money than you'd expect for a party of that size. And part of that is legacy, and part of that is that it obviously was a significant party, radical right party. The party has shifted, as we've said, over the years to a very comfortably far right position. She's probably the best name running. She is a campaigner in the sense that she does get out. She, you know, as you say, she was being a Hartlepool parliamentary candidate. She moved over there and spent a lot of time there.
She's a parish councillor up there as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, she actually does do a bit of campaigning, which is, you can't say for much of that organisation, which is increasingly made up of kind of octogenarians. But if she wins, it won't have a huge impact. If she loses, it won't have a huge impact. But we'll let you know when it happens.
We'll let you know when she does lose. I just thought it might be worth knowing.
Yeah, no, it's worth saying, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then finally, I mean, is there anything else you want to touch on? I mean, we put this piece out earlier on in the month about the real shambles, the collapse of the far-right element at the main gate Scampton site. I mean, there's been recriminations just flying ever since then. I mean, people are very, very angry up there. People who are listening who don't know, there was for over 100 days, there was a kind of far-right blockade of the main gate of the RAF Scampton site, where there's government plans to temporarily house refugees, migrants and asylum seekers. And the far right swooped in, took it over, and it was a complete and utter disaster, and they all fell out, and it's been a real shit show, basically. And I just want to flag this, because I think there's a lot of arguments still flying around, because they managed to bleed a lot of support for this project, with drug taking, drinking, infighting, quite literally a physical fight at one point towards the end, and it's really, really damaged a lot of kind of some of the bigger names, I suppose, in the movement. I think they will be forever attached to this project, which was a disaster. Is there anything you want to mention on that, Joe?
No. I mean, the article on the website's great. So yeah, if you are interested in all the ins and outs of that, it's definitely worth having a read.
Nice. Okay, mate. Well, look, really good to talk to you. Anything else you want to touch on before we go?
That's everything. I feel like that was like a bit of a cathartic catch up. It was nice,
wasn't it? Yeah, it was good. We'll have to do another one. I think I'm going to have an episode out with Georgie next week, talking about the general election, just kind of broad stuff on the general election. And then we'll come back week after next with some more hot takes, I'm sure. But good to chat to you, mate, and we'll speak soon. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Cheers.
Take care.
You cannot prevent 50 people, 50 postmen or 50 dustmen from having anti-Semitic thoughts. But you can prevent 50 dustmen forming an anti-Semitic dustmen association. take the fight of the enemy and attack those before they attack you.